The killing of prominent Palestinians such as poet Rafat Al-Arir put more names and faces to Israel's crimes. Young people around the world are understanding that the diplomatic protection Israel receives from the United States in its UN Security Council veto costs lives.
When the UN vote concluded, I couldn't believe that they were really concerned about the loss of life. The United Nations should have called for a ceasefire. I am really disappointed that the UN seems like it wants world peace, but then says that such massacres are okay.
South Korea abstained from the most recent UN vote calling for a ceasefire. Still, as some Americans' criticism of Israel is muzzled, protesters in South Korea can say what they mean. As Israel continues its onslaught against the Palestinian people, the subject seems to have declined in prominence in the mainstream media around the globe. These demonstrators here, circling the Israeli embassy week in and week out, seek to remind people that the Israeli army is killing an innocent woman or child every few minutes. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Since the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979, Iran has managed to foster a close relationship with Latin American nations, particularly those with a history of fighting imperialism and global hegemony led by the U.S., such as Cuba, Venezuela, and Bolivia. In recent years, Iran has managed to increase the scale and scope of its diplomatic and economic ties with Latin American nations. In this regard, Tehran has hosted the first edition of an international conference named 120 Years of Iran-Latin America Relations. The event was held at Tehran University. The organizers said the conference is aimed at reviewing the relations of Latin American countries with Iran and is considered an opportunity for researchers and political analysts to draw a new roadmap for communication and interaction in the future. Attending the event, the Iranian Culture and Islamic Guidance Minister said Iran and Latin American countries have a lot in common.
We seek to expand ties with Latin American nations. Definitely the U.S. and other hegemonic states are against any form of cooperation between like-minded countries. However, we believe that by boosting relations through cultural exchanges, our friendship will be long-lasting.
A number of Latin American ambassadors were present at the conference. They hailed the event as significant, calling for further expansion of ties.
The marking of 120 years of Iran-Latin America relations is a very important event. The main challenge we're facing today is culture. Despite extended political and economic ties between Tehran and Latin American nations, cultural ties require further expansion.
On the sideline of the conference, we asked the new Brazilian ambassador to Iran about the significance of Iran's cooperation with Latin American countries, especially Brazil, through mechanisms such as BRICS.
There will be new mechanisms to facilitate the trade. And in this, if this happens, not only Brazil, but other Latin American countries will have much more opportunity to have trade with Brazil. Last week, I received a big delegation from Brazil to purchase urea fertilizers for Brazil. So, to increase the imports from Iran and to, well, equilibrate a little more the economy. But I think with those businessmen in Brazil, with the high-level visits in the horizon, and with new inventions of trade without depending on the other countries, I think we will have lots of new opportunities in the future.
Despite the geographical distance and cultural differences, Iran's political and economic relations with Latin American countries have grown warmer in recent years.
The next edition of this cultural event will be hosted by Venezuela in 2024. Matia Pusyan, Tehran.
As Israeli bombs continue to shatter lives and limbs in Gaza, calls for them to stop continue to grow louder. More than 100,000 Britons in London have joined protesters in other European capitals to repeat the same demands.
ceasefire, obviously, but obviously I want a political solution that means that everyone in the region can live with dignity.
This genocide has to stop. It's a genocidal war supported by a British government which sees no reality and no humanity.
Reality and humanity that these demonstrators are here to highlight. And as always, they are a mixed crowd. Muslims, Christians, people of no faith, and Jewish people such as Amy, who are saying, not in our name.
I reject this whole idea that Israel is the only safe space for Jews, because there is nothing safe about having a country that is illegally occupying another group of people who are already living there.
In addition to calling for an end to the bloodshed, the protesters here say they are outraged by the double standards, by the government's complicit silence in the massive atrocities that Israel is committing against the Palestinians, and also its refusal to listen to calls for a permanent ceasefire.
The rally comes hot on the heels of a UN Security Council vote on a humanitarian pause, which the US vetoed and the UK abstained from.
The fact that our government is one of only two that fails to vote for that is utterly, utterly shameful. The message of the British government at the moment to the Palestinian people is not enough of you have died.
What is the point of these protests if the leaders aren't listening, one might ask? But there are signs that public pressure is working.
We're seeing a shift in the position of European governments like France. Now, why are they shifting? It's not suddenly that Emmanuel Macron has woken up and found a conscience. He's been put under pressure by recognizing popular opinion in his country. We are already seeing cracks in the US position. Yes, they vetoed yesterday, but they're under pressure, and they're having to now say to Israel, you need to stop killing so many civilians. So we have to keep up the popular pressure, and we have to do the same in the UK.
Whether or not governments are listening to their people, without a permanent ceasefire, mass Palestine solidarity demonstrations such as this one will become a common sight in Western capitals. Saipur is up, London.
On Saturday, a conference dubbed the Gaza Strip Out of the War took place in the auditorium of the Spin Time Labs, a large squat in the center of the Italian capital. The initiative, attended by a number of authoritative speakers and representatives of the Palestinian community in Italy, aimed at stressing how Western countries should assume responsibilities for the ongoing massacre of civilians in the Gaza Strip. Some speakers denounced how they are often censored by mainstream media for calling for peace in Gaza.
Unfortunately, our mainstream media follow the line dictated by the U.S. and by NATO. As a consequence, all peace efforts, all attempts to stop the war, are concealed. Most surveys show that the majority of the Italians are against fueling wars. Today, we're trying to give voice to these calls.
Conference speakers also condemned the United States for vetoing a UN resolution calling for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire in the Gaza Strip and supporting Israel's aggression that has killed more than 17,000 Palestinians, most of whom are women and children, injuring at least 46,000 others in just 2 months of conflict.
This way, the U.S. continues to back Israel's extermination of Palestinians with the goal to drive our people out of Gaza towards Egypt, and after that, to drive our people out of the West Bank towards Jordan. Israel is the watchdog of the colonialist Western Empire in the Middle East, period.
The remaining 13 of the 15 current members of the United Nations Security Council voted in favor of the resolution put forward by the United Arab Emirates and co-sponsored by 100 other countries, while the United Kingdom abstained. The role of the European Union in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict was also discussed at the conference. So far, EU's political leaders have been mostly speaking with one voice, backing Netanyahu and continuously reaffirming that Israel has the right to defend itself without any reference to the fact that Tel Aviv is an occupying force which is perpetrating crimes against humanity in Gaza on a daily basis.
Unfortunately, the EU has lost its status as a significant player. When a major war breaks out, all vassal entities tend to line up with the hegemony. The EU today overlooks the interests of its people and has given up its role of impartial mediator in any future peace process in order to accommodate US requests.
The Rome conference ended with a focus on the occupied West Bank. Israeli forces have intensified their attacks there. Max Civili, Rome.
Signaling the dawn of a new era of enhanced cooperation. Less than 6 months after the Iranian president's historic trip to Damascus, Syria's prime minister is in Tehran with a high-ranking delegation for a three-day visit that will include meetings with Iran's president, the parliament speaker, and the secretary of the Supreme National Security Council, all in line with the implementation of bilateral agreements signed during President Raisi's visit to Syria back in May. The Syrian prime minister signed 6 agreements with Iran's vice president Mohammad Mokhber that will pave the way for taking practical measures to boost cooperation based on the bilateral agreements.
Strengthening ties with Syria is among Iran's strategies that leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has always emphasized, and Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi has also pursued. We are determined to broaden economic cooperation with Syria. Our main priority is peace and security in the region and the independence and welfare of the Syrian people.
Both Iran and Syria are now looking forward to strengthen ties in various areas, including trade, oil and energy, engineering, housing, communications and technology, as well as tourism and pilgrimage to holy sites. In this regard, developing transportation routes between the two countries has been one of the major achievements of the top Syrian official's trip to Tehran.
Our countries have deep-rooted historical and strategic ties, and the Syrian nation will never forget the Iranian government and people's support at times of need. Iran can play a significant role in the reconstruction of Syria, and we consider Iran a major partner in this process.
The visit comes as the Iran-Syria Joint Economic Commission is underway in Tehran, holding its 15th round of meetings, which the Syrian prime minister has attended in order to give the go-ahead for implementing bilateral trade agreements, most notably setting up a free trade zone and removing trade tariffs based on the free trade deal between Tehran and Damascus. With the Syrian prime minister's trip to Tehran and the implementation of bilateral agreements, Iran and Syria are now closer than ever, entering a new era of strengthened ties and enhanced cooperation. Gisumish Ahmadi, Tehran.
The streets of the Yemeni capital were once again the scene of a pro-Palestinian protest, condemning the 2 months of Israeli genocide against the Palestinians. Protesters shouted anti-US and Israeli slogans and denounced all those who are supporting the continuous Israeli war crimes in the Gaza Strip.
No matter how many people betray the people of Palestine, and no matter how many presidents and governments side with the Israeli regime, the people of Yemen are ready to support Palestine with money, weapons, and we are also ready to fight alongside our Palestinian brothers.
Prominent Ansar Allah official Muhammad Ali al-Houthi also slammed the Arab and Islamic world's reluctance to take meaningful actions against Israel to save the lives of Gazans.
The Arab and Islamic world is outraged with what they are seeing in Palestine. We continue to watch the sad and depressing footage coming out of Palestine, but we need to take more actions in every aspect. As the leader of the revolution has said, we need to mobilize more in protesting in our media coverage and also militarily.
Muhammad Ali also addressed U.S. latest plan to form a NATO-like coalition force to protect the Red Sea.
Today, America is calling for the formation of a big coalition which should also include Arab regimes for the protection of the Red Sea. However, we tell those who are thinking about protecting the Red Sea to first protect the Rafah borders before sending your armies against your brothers.
For the time being, Yemen's armed forces will continue to target Israel with drones and ballistic missiles. This in addition to the targeting of any ships linked to the Israeli regime attempting to cross Yemen's Bab al-Mandeb Strait.
The Yemeni armed forces are calling on residents in occupied Palestine to evacuate all areas near Israeli military sites because these are considered legit military targets as long as the regime's onslaught continues on the besieged Gaza Strip. Yusuf Mawdi, Sana'a.
Since the beginning of Israeli aggression on Gaza, the Indian news channels have been busy debating and only promoting the Israeli side of the narrative. However, protests, gatherings or discussions on Israeli genocide against Palestinians have been strictly forbidden, including in schools, colleges and universities. Experts say this could lead to a greater suppression of Muslims in India and further escalation of Islamophobia.
Islamophobia in India has increased in last 10-20 years to an extent that anything which is related to Muslims or Islam is seen with suspicion, even hatred. And that's why if you say something which is seen as being sympathetic to Palestinians, that would not be allowed.
Despite Palestinian plight being suppressed in this part of the world, there are many who leave no stone unturned to highlight the issue and enlighten the masses about the real history of the aggression. A case in point was this seminar organized to address human rights violations across the globe, particularly against women and children. The speakers, mostly women, blasted the utter failure of the United Nations to put an end to the Gaza carnage. The participants of the seminar condemned the Israeli onslaught on Gaza, calling it ethnic cleansing of Palestinians.
It's also part of a much longer standing suppression of dissent over the last decade, since the BJP came to power, where various events on campus have been cancelled. So anything to do with the constitution, with discussions of human rights, democracy, Kashmir, Maoism, all of these have become taboo subjects. So Palestine has been added to the list of taboo subjects. So there are four reasons. There's a technological arms reason, there's the ideological reason, there's the Islamophobia reason, and there's the longer suppression of dissent reason.
Observers say it's not just the issue of Palestine that is being barred in the academics or criminalized in the public spheres, but the issues related to the Muslims of the country are being sidelined and seen in the prism of rising Islamophobia. Experts say the term Muslim or Islam has become a political tool since decades to garner votes ahead of elections by polarizing voters. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. and hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure, and provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
From Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. The Palestinians in Gaza are facing a multi-pronged U.S.-Israeli genocide. From the almost constant bombings from the air, tank shelling on the ground, sniper fire from regime troops in various areas in the Strip, along with kidnappings, Palestinians are also facing starvation and dehydration and a lack of medicine and medical supplies to heal their wounds. This as people have been displaced and are walking from the north to the south and back to the central areas of Gaza. Still, they are targeted no matter what part of the Gaza Strip they are in. Nowhere is safe in Gaza, as those who can stop the war either continue to support the regime or simply look the other way. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Anthony Hall, Professor of Globalization, Lethbridge University. Harley Schlanger, spokesman of La Ruche organization out of Potsdam, Germany. Thank you both for being with us. I'd like to start it off with Anthony. I mean, as we are speaking, more children are being killed in Gaza. How can the world, our world governments, be so detached from this loss of life of Palestinian kids and just continue to let it happen?
It's really something to behold, something terrible, frightening, and appalling to behold. I never thought I would see such a thing. One of the things that Israel is going to have to deal with for the rest of its life is people around the world will say, Israel, that's the baby-killing country, right? They're the people who like to murder babies en masse. The idea that this is about eradicating Hamas and making this particular organization the subject of the war. No, this is a war of depopulation. This is a war of extermination. This is a genocidal, it's classic genocide. And there should by now be a process started, which could happen easily in the International Court of Justice, not in the ICC, the International Criminal Court, which is a puppet court, which is a Western U.S. dominated, you know, crap court. The International Criminal Court could pursue classic charges. This is a classic violation of the Genocide Convention. We need to consider, of course, you know, first and foremost, the human impact of people facing what the people inside this prison who, you know, briefly made a prison break, and the whole question of what really happened on October the 7th hasn't really been answered. There's so many mysteries about what really went on. But right now, as the world can't find a way to watch, of course, the Palestinians have this feeling of being abandoned, always abandoned. There'll be motions, there'll be bold words, but right now is a very clear illustration that there is no rule of law in this world, that at the highest level of criminality, the organized criminals get their way. And I'll end it there, but I look forward to a good exchange. Nice to see you, Marcy.
Nice seeing you, Anthony. Well, Harley, even if some kids are surviving the bomb attacks, I mean, many are dying from the lack of water, lack of food, lack of medical supplies. Why can't the crossings be open to allow these basic necessities, essentials, at least, to enter Gaza? Why isn't there more pressure to at least allow that to happen?
Well, I think I want to, first of all, agree with what Anthony said about this being a war of depopulation. This is an attempt to continue, after many years' absence, but although a continuing operation, the Nakba, the driving of the Palestinians out of Palestine. And they're going to do it through bombs. They're going to do it through disease. You know, it was very interesting to hear an Israeli doctor say that, well, we have to worry about disease because it might spread to the Israeli soldiers. But no concern for the Palestinian children and mothers and fathers who are facing disease every day from lack of clean water, lack of sanitation, and so on. And I think what I want to focus on is the fact that President Biden has, according to very well-placed sources, told Netanyahu, you have to finish this up by the end of January, because otherwise it will become out of control. The opposition to Israel will go out of control. Well, 2 points on that. First of all, how many more children will die by the end of January, number one? Number two, what makes you think Netanyahu will stop? He's not going to stop. He's going to go as long as he's given a free rein, and the United States is giving him a free rein. The other point that should be made is that most of the world has now at least indicated they oppose what's going on. The World Health Organization just came out and said there has to be not just supplies, humanitarian supplies, but a ceasefire. There's a cry for a ceasefire from much of the world, but it won't matter until the United States changes policy. Now, interesting, there was a poll that came out yesterday that showed that only 19% of Americans under 30 years old, that is the younger generation, only 19% support Biden's support of Netanyahu. Altogether, 61% now of U.S. voters are saying they want a permanent ceasefire. There was a letter released that was signed by 600 leaders of American Jewish organizations saying a ceasefire is a moral necessity. The problem is that Biden doesn't answer to the American people. He doesn't answer to the people of Palestine or the people of anywhere. He answers to the military industrial machine that is totally willing to allow Israel to carry out this atrocity.
But Harley, let me just jump in here. Isn't it because it's really important, I think, the way all of this is being framed, as if it's Netanyahu and Biden. Isn't it both regimes in general, whether we're talking about, the previous president and what happened when looking at Palestine, and also we look at the various prime ministers of the Israeli regime, isn't it, it's not about these individuals, but it is about what these regimes are after to begin with.
It's about the system, and both of these regimes are part of a system of depopulation, which includes the economic oppression of most of the global south, which is starting to rise up. It includes the unwillingness to invest in health and infrastructure in these countries. But in this case, you're absolutely right. The whole Congress, virtually the whole U.S. Congress, is in unison on support for the Netanyahu regime. And even people in Israel and in the Knesset who are getting weak stomachs about what's going on, they're still not speaking out. So it is the two systems, and these two systems are largely controlled by an interlocking network of corporate cartels that cares not one bit for the lives of Palestinians, but will weep crocodile tears over the lives of Israelis.
Right, indeed. Well, Anthony, is this all about Americans and Israelis just wanting the resources of Gaza for themselves, or is it about the sheer hatred that they have for Palestinians? I mean, your assessment about it all.
Well, we could talk about Biden and we can talk about Netanyahu. And I do think that Netanyahu actually is a psychologically sick individual right now who probably needs to be in care. And, you know, somehow Israel is destroying itself by not taking his hands off the steering wheel, this madman who, you know, seems to be having a breakdown. But let's get away from, you know, okay, there's a corporate syndicate, large corporations, there's Netanyahu, there's Biden, but there's something called Zionism. Zionism, the philosophy that got rolling in terms of this project of establishing a Jewish state, this project that got rolling with Rothschild bankers, this project that has a lot to do with the same dynamics of the larger depopulation initiative in the world, which is a banking cartel thing to further the power of banking, which is closely interacted, which is closely intertwined with this thing called Zionism. And it seems to me that when we put the focus there, we're talking about Israel, we're talking about the United States. Both are in under the authority, the control of the same chain of command, which is a Zionist chain of command. And it's perfectly appropriate that Biden be considered every much and even possibly more so responsible than Netanyahu. But we have a system of Zionism, which is a system of Jewish supremacism, which is a system of Talmudic sort of breeding of hatred towards all kinds of people, of supremacism, of chosen peopleism, of the idea that some kind of people are more privileged in the eyes of God, and the Palestinians are clearly in the school of this thing called terrorism. And, you know, Netanyahu is a master of using this concept of Islamic terror as a political bicycle, as a political engine for his career, for his incredible career. And let's remember that he got 39 standing ovations in Congress. And so he is arguably the most influential person in the world in terms of influencing Congress. And Congress is bought and paid for because the system of banking produces a tremendous concentration of wealth, which goes into a very specific ethnic channels and whatnot, and enables Zionists to purchase the presidents, the Congress people, the corporations, the media, the courts. And okay, we're now sort of face to face with this fact that any concept that there is anything like a rule of law in charge here has been wiped away. It's been unmasked. And I think my colleague brings up this population scheme. I mean, let's remember that Netanyahu was quite involved in the COVID scam and was, you know, dealing with Albert Bourla, and millions of people have died worldwide from
Let me cross over and get Harley back in on this conversation. I mean, your take, when we see on a daily basis, we see various international organizations, they may condemn what is happening and say that relief is needed. At the bottom line, nothing really happens. And so when we say that, or we see that none of these international organizations are able to do what they say they are set up to do, isn't that evidence that either they were set up to begin with just to protect American interests, or they fear the reprisals from the American regime, and either way that these organizations cannot truly serve the world's people? I mean, your assessment, and do we not need an alternative to all of this?
Well, we absolutely need an alternative, and it's starting to come into existence. I agree with everything that you said and that Anthony said about the question of Zionism, except that I see Zionism as a tool of the biggest powers in the world, and Zionism is really racism. He's absolutely right about that, Jewish supremacy. But it doesn't represent a Jewish religious view. The important thing is Zionism was used by the British at the beginning of the last century as a way of controlling the geopolitical situation in what we call today the Middle East. And it's being used again for the same purpose. And if I can just make this point, we're seeing emerge the biggest anti-colonial reaction in the world, of which the uprising in Gaza is a part of it. But it's also part of the global South rising up against the International Monetary Fund, against the Green Agenda, against US and British imperialism, against French imperialism. We're seeing a global reawakening, and this is what is actually happening. The problem is the people who are responsible for this imperial geopolitical game are willing to kill large numbers of people, including leaders of nations, assassinations, regime change. Look at the U.S. policy toward Iraq, toward Afghanistan, toward Syria, towards Libya, towards Lebanon. But one of the things that's important to note, and this is where I think the alternative can come from, the BRICS. The new members of the BRICS are all in this region. And the question is, will Russia and China step forward more than they have so far as a counterweight to the United States? The United States is trying to destroy Russia and Ukraine. It's not working. But this is where the alternative system can come from: de-dollarization, control of oil. You know, the new members of the BRICS include Saudi Arabia, UAE, Iran, and Egypt, among them leading powers in the energy field. So this can be broken, but it has to be broken on top of everything else by the American people, and they have to stop sitting there watching on television and doing nothing. And what my organization is involved in the United States is building an international peace coalition which will force the hand of the Congress to act against this. That's a hard thing to do because the Congress is bought and paid, but ultimately they have to get votes.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, what about a possibility of actually Americans not paying their taxes, Anthony? I mean, Could that be an effective tool to have a major effect on American policy, or how do you see it?
Well, that is a kind of obvious thing to do when you see the money being used to promote genocide. We have an abstract view of it supplying bombs and such, but now we see it close up. Now, the American people, like people throughout the West, are experience what it feels like to be colonized, to be subject to a government that may pretend to listen to you but really has no interest in you. Now, this global South, this BRICS, these are people who lived in colonies of Europe. And, you know, they've been around in different forms, in different ways. Now, BRICS was created by Goldman Sachs. That was a concept. So there is a kind of banker's infiltration taking place. And WEF also uses the word multipolarism, like Russia does. There's a certain way that language is, you know, there's an ambivalence to it. But I'm thinking back in the 1950s and 1960s, the people who we now call the Global South, they were coming together in the non-aligned movement.
Exactly.
That came together at Bandung, and they were trying to avoid the imperialism of the Cold War, this being forced into a choice. You can either choose the Soviet or the U.S. system, but you've got to choose between the two. And they said, no, we want to be our own people. We want to have our own self-determination. We don't want to have this false choice forced on us. So this non-aligned movement now appears as, you know, the Global South, BRICS. And it's, again, a question of, well, we were colonized. Our parents know what it means to live in a colonized situation. The Palestinians right now are manifesting what it means to be colonized, to not even have your lives being considered as worthy of sustaining, let alone your capital or your businesses or your natural resources. Now it's the very lives that are to be removed. And there is this feeling in Europe and in America and in my country in Canada that we are being colonized, and we, the people of the world, are being ignored, and we are being run through a series of stages into our demise, into sickness, into enfeeblement. We're going to stop oil and gas. We're just going to make a monastic vow, and we can't have fertilizer, and we can't have, we've got to live in 15-minute cities, and then along comes, COVID, and along comes Gaza, and so this urgency for the people of the world to find a way, you know, not through the United Nations, unless the United Nations can do something to demonstrate it's not irrelevant. United Nations is basically a place where the likes of Biden, just show they're in charge. The veto that we just saw one country express because they were a winner in World War II. It's kind of the last possibility for the UN to show some capacity to be a focus of global mobilization for justice. But somehow or other, it's this colonization process, settler colonialism. Of course, in 1967, when all of this was taking place, Israel was conquering the territories that were meant to be part of the Arab country in Resolution 181. And so they were doing a war of imperial conquest as decolonization was happening elsewhere in the world. And that's Israel's big problem. They are the inheritors of the Anglo-American Empire. They are the cutting edge. They are the embodiment of imperialism. And they've got to try to appear like they're not.
Okay.
But they are the embodiments and inheritors of the worst, most brutal oppression of imperialism that since 1492 has been, you know, very clear.
Okay. Well, Harley, I mean, as the world is witnessing this genocide live, how do you think it will be affected, the world itself? I mean, is this the transition point? Are we transforming from this control of this liberal world order to an alternative? Or where do you see us as a human race? I mean, Where are we right now if you had to assess what's going on and where we're going?
Well, we're in a transition period. The problem is a transition period can be very long and very deadly for people who lack power. I mean, if you look at the Palestinians, they don't have an army. They have committed fighters, but they don't have an army. They're up against jets and rockets and AI and all of the capabilities that the United States can pour into Israel. And if it worse comes to worse, Israel still has nuclear weapons. So the question here, and I, again, I think my colleague is absolutely right, this is the ultimate battle against a colonial system. And we never had a full decolonization in the 50s and 60s. This was the whole point of the post-Bretton Woods system, where instead of having new institutions of economic development, it was a dollar system. It was controlled by London and Wall Street. It still is. Israel is a junior partner in this, but a very bloody, dangerous junior partner. So the question that you just posed is absolutely right. Will the people in the West who are suffering? I mean, look, I live in Germany. Germany is going into a fairly deep collapse. The political parties are hated by most people, and yet they're passive in the face of this. And the German government is going out and threatening people. If you speak out against Israel, you're an anti-Semite, you're a Hitler. So they're using the most brutal tactics in the West to silence opposition to this colonial system. But it's not going to stop it. And as long as the Palestinians are demonstrating this form of courage and fighting, it should inspire people in other nations. And I don't mean necessarily fighting, I mean forming alliances to run out of office these corrupt individuals who have become extremely wealthy as a result of their support for the military-industrial complex. So it is a transition period. It's going to take longer than I think most people would like. But in the end, the U.S., if it doesn't change its policy, it has already lost credibility. All parties. Israel has lost credibility for the next hundreds of years. And the question then is, can we bring something new out of this, which does recognize the humanity of all people, as opposed to accepting the idea that some people are more deserving of life than others?
Okay, and on that note, I'd like to thank both of you for being with me for this spotlight. Anthony Hall out of Lethbridge, Canada, Harley Schlenker out of Potsdam, Germany. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing off for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio.
Al-Aqsa Storm Aftermath. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. October 7th, 2023 was a turning point in the history of the West Asian region, and it will remain forever. On that day, the combatants of the Palestinian Hamas movement launched a surprise attack against the Zionist regime and imposed the biggest defeat on the regime since its illegitimate birth 75 years ago. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, dubbed the defeat as an irreparable defeat. We are going to review the issue in a special series with a focus on the Al-Aqsa Storm and its consequences. Stay tuned for the second part, please. Thank you. Did Hamas start Operation Al-Aqsa Storm unethically? After the successful Operation Al-Aqsa Storm, the enemies of Hamas and supporters of the Zionist regime, who had been stunned and bewildered by the great defeat, tried to question the ethically of Hamas measure. The opponents claimed that Hamas had maltreated the Zionist captives and caused the Zionist regime to launch genocide on the people of Gaza. Both claims, however, were proved false very soon. Some of the journalists who had spoken of the violence of Hamas admitted that they had raised such allegations after the claims of Zionists. Furthermore, some of the Zionist citizens officially announced that the combatants of Hamas had no misbehavior or violence against them whatsoever. In addition, this operation of Hamas was a natural reaction to over 75 years of crimes, including 17 years of the siege on Gaza by Zionists. The child-killing regime even resorted to excessive violence and savagery during the return of the Palestinians, killing hundreds of civilians in cold blood. Every year, a big number of women and children are murdered or injured by the Zionist military or settlers. This is while there is no place for speaking of ethical issues on this scale of criminality and barbarity. Now the question is, was the Hamas attack worth it? 3 points should be noted here. The first point is that the opponents of Hamas, instead of condemning the Zionist regime's genocidal war on Gaza, call it as a reaction to Al-Aqsa Storm to pressure Hamas and delegitimize its operation. The second point is that although Hamas is much weaker than the Israeli army, both quantitatively and qualitatively, it followed the model of Imam Hussein's battle against the forces of Yazid, but didn't accept humility. The third point is that Operation Al-Aqsa Storm has brought about great achievements for Palestine, some of which are the return of the issue of Palestine to the core of the West Asian discussions. The Zionist regime had tried for the recent years to trivialize the issue of Palestine, but Al-Aqsa Storm frustrated all these efforts. The second achievement is that it widened the rift between the stances of people and governments in Arab countries to create a new wave of moves in support of Palestine. The third achievement is that the issue of normalization of ties with Israel, which was going to turn into a very common and accepted issue among most of the Arab states, has now become a taboo and treacherous act. Saudi Arabia was in the brink of this betrayal, but Al-Aqsa Storm shattered this trend. Operation Al-Aqsa Storm has shattered the myth of invincibility of the Israeli army for good, and the Zionist regime will never be able to repair this debacle. The fourth achievement of Al-Aqsa Storm is that it proved the volatility and fragility of conditions inside the occupied territories. Thomas Friedman wrote in an article that Israel in the post-October 7th era is not the previous Israel by any means. It has changed into a place where the inhabitants had never lived in such circumstances. It is the place where the Israeli generals had never been forced to safeguard it, and an ally like the US had never been forced to directly intervene and defend. Will Hamas be destroyed? One of the most important goals of the Zionist regime in the war against Gaza is to destroy Hamas movement. The Zionist regime used to think that Hamas had exited the resistance front and intended to negotiate and compromise with the regime. Al-Aqsa Storm, however, was a gargantuan intelligence fiasco for the Zionist regime because it proved that not only their take on Hamas was quite false, but also Hamas had been planning for the operation for at least 1 year. While the Zionists tried for 50 years to find Hamas combatants, they totally failed. Richard Haass, head of the U.S. Foreign Relations Council, said that Hamas can never be omitted and it may even become stronger. He continues that Hamas is not just an army to end with destroying it. It is rather a thought and ideology. Michael Milstein, the head of Palestinian Studies Association at Tel Aviv University, believes that apart from over 25,000 military members of Hamas, 80 to 90,000 members are active in the social infrastructure of Hamas called Al-Dawa. Dear listeners, this discussion will be continued in the next episode.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.